2022. So welcome, everybody. And I guess I'm just being crossed off here on my screen. But, you know, we've got all of you that are sitting around the table and joining us online are the regulars, and I'm the new guy on the block. So I am Paul Etke. I represent Senate District 2 up in northwestern Minnesota, which consists of all or parts of 8 counties. So I'm just happy to be with everyone on this committee and look forward to working with you throughout this session. And with that, we'll just jump right into our agenda for today. We are going to get a report from Commissioner Malcolm in the department on the COVID-19 flexible response funds and what has been taking place over the last numbers of months and part of the year. So Commissioner Malcolm, I think before my screen jumped here, I saw you. All right, there she is. Welcome to our committee. And just to please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. I believe you've got some slides that you're going to be sharing with us.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to see you, even virtually. Thank you so much for this time today to give you an update on the flexible funds that the LCRC has helped us with approval on, as well as to address some of your questions about the current status of monoclonal antibody treatment. Hopefully you can see the slides as we go. I'm going to go really quickly. I think you have these slides before you. I'll go quickly. I do have some MDH colleagues with me who can help to answer some of your more detailed questions. First, we'll talk about the flexible funds of $40 million that was approved out of federal ARP funds to help us set up an emergency staffing pool for our hospitals. And the need for that was pretty clear. As you all know, certainly our hospitals have been under enormous stress for 2 years now with the burden of COVID, also lots and lots of other critically needed care going on in our hospitals. They're very full. Their staff have been through a lot. There's been a number of folks who've left the field. We actually have less staffing now than we did a year ago. So the systems have been making a lot of use of temporary staffing, but the Omicron surge, when it hit, just really further exacerbated the staffing crisis in our hospitals. Between both the patient load and the number of providers who became infected and were out for either isolation, quarantine, or caring for family members and the like. So in consultation with our hospital leaders, we went to work to try to augment their ability to get temporary staffing by signing a state contract with a large, very reputable staffing firm that we had good reports on from other states who'd used them. And that vendor is really doing a good job for us. The contract is for them to supply 199 registered nurses and 20 respiratory therapists to be able to backfill in our hospitals. Each of these staff work extended hours, 60-hour work weeks for a 60-day period of time under the contract. So that is the equivalent of 330 FTEs. These resources are allocated through our regional healthcare preparedness coalitions, which all of the hospitals in a region work together with their coalitions to coordinate resources in that region. So where the resources are going is really determined by those regional coalitions. There is a 25% hospital cost share. So any hospital that is getting staff through this emergency pool contributes 25% of the cost of that staffing support, with these federal resources able to provide 75% of the support, so much needed support to our hospitals. We started working on this and really stood it up within 1 week's time, which was pretty remarkable, and certainly appreciate the LCRC's quick action on this as well. So we executed this contract with the firm on the 15th of January, It became really quite clear to us by the end of the first week in January that a further state contract would be helpful to the hospitals. So to get it executed 1 week later was a very good thing. As of today, there are 140 healthcare providers on the ground providing care as a part of this contract. The firm continues to recruit for workers, and there is some turnover, some replacement of workers that has to happen. So the next slide gives you a picture of where those resources are deployed. If you can see that there, the blue, dark blue colored counties do not have any of these resources. But again, regionally, we're trying to make sure that everybody can be supported. The gray have between 3 and 5 staff out of this pool, the light green 1 or 2, the orange 6 to 10, the brighter blue 11 to 20, and the red 21 plus. So as you can see, the metropolitan Twin Cities area has the bulk of these resources, which is because they have the majority of the med-surg and ICU beds that are in use for COVID, and they are, with the staffing, able to take more referrals from the hospitals that need to move their patients to a higher level of care. So that is where the resources have gone. Next slide, please. So that actually, let's pause there for a moment, and before going on to the next piece of the strategy, the hospital decompression. Assistant Commissioner Diane Rydrick is on the meeting with us. Diane, anything you would add on the emergency staffing pool, and then certainly members open for your questions on this topic.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm an acting assistant commissioner here at the Health Department. I don't think I have anything to add to what Commissioner Malcolm said, but I am happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. First up, we've got Senator Klein.
Thank you, Chair Utke and Commissioner Malcolm. So fascinating and impressive work addressing very quickly the central problem that we have with healthcare delivery right now, which is this shortage of healthcare workers for the reasons you explained, but you were able to turn it around pretty rapidly. And I guess we're as a committee, I think, going to be struggling with what solutions work and what don't to sort of stabilize the healthcare worker workforce this coming year. And I would appreciate any further insights you have on, you know, where were these nurses procured from? Did they come from other states? Obviously, every state must be competing for the same staff. How were we successful above others? Did we just offer better salary and benefits? Or I guess what worked? Can you give us any more insight? And where did they come from?
Commissioner Malcolm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Klein. I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Rydrick to help me out here with this. This is, as I mentioned, a large national staffing agency that had worked in some other states that we were familiar with and gave this firm very good reviews. So you're absolutely right. This is a national issue. And I can't speak to how the terms of our contract may have differed from other states, but I think completed some of the deployments, the assignments to some other markets that were a little bit ahead of us in the Omicron wave. But Diane, I don't know if you would have anything to add on any more detail on where the staff came from.
Assistant Commissioner Rydrick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Klein. Commissioner Malcolm is correct. Most of these individuals have come from other states. There's a provision in the contract that says that these nurses who are med-surg and ICU nurses can't come from existing jobs in Minnesota hospitals. They cannot be hired away from Minnesota hospitals. So they have come from other states. I don't know which states they have come from. I will tell you that there are some who came here, decided they didn't like the winter weather of January, and then decided that they didn't want to be here and needed to be replaced. So some from warmer weather states, that's for sure. It is a nationwide issue, and you know, I think we benefited in some ways from being a little bit farther behind on the Omicron wave than some of the states out east in particular, where the northeastern states were seeing their surges come down a little bit sooner than we did. And so there were some individuals who were in these traveling roles who were freed up from earlier engagements and were able to come here. But it is a challenge. Everyone is kind of fishing in the same pool for these staff. And as a result, you know, we've seen wages go up and we've seen that it's been more challenging to recruit them.
Thank you. Senator Klein, any follow-up? Okay, thank you. Senator Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate it. Kind of to follow up on Senator Klein's comment or question is that, so give us, can you break down the associated costs? We're translating or we're seeking help. Sounds like they're mostly from outside of Minnesota, not all from outside Minnesota. But what's the hourly wage that we're contracted for, the lodging, per diem, and other associated costs for each and every one of those contracted nurses that we're bringing in from other states?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Curran, I don't have that detail. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Reiterich has that at hand, but I believe we could probably get that for you out of the contract if we don't have it with us right now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator
Curran. Commissioner Malcolm, I believe you have a significant number of your support staff who are on here. We're going to be here for the next hour, and so the contract is really fresh. You guys just executed in rapid time, which you just indicated as such in your opening testimony. So we would like to request that you provide that. Have somebody that's listening and or those that are on the support team, please provide it. It should be very easy and quick to obtain. Thank you.
So,
thank you. Commissioner Malcolm, is that something that works for you, or should we take that as a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, we certainly will see if we can get that during the hearing, and if not, we will get it to you right afterwards.
Okay, thank you. Senator Nelson, you've got a question. I see your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions are similar. I'll just add a little more to them if they have not been answered. But one, you know, good job getting the medical personnel that we need here. So I greatly appreciate that. I'm sure the families of those who are hospitalized do as well. What I would want to know is, and if it was in your slides previously, I apologize. I wasn't able to get back to look at it. I would really like to get a better understanding of how this nurse, particularly nursing shortage, was met. In other words, how many nurses have we brought in from other states? And where, it would be very helpful to get an idea of where those nurses came from, you know, how many from each state, that type of thing. And then again, as my colleagues have already talked about, the cost, because this is an ongoing issue only made worse by COVID. And so I think it's really important that we get the data behind us, we get a better understanding of what is working here, how is it that we got these nurses, and also if possible, Commissioner, you mentioned that some of the nurses are kind of like traveling nurses, right? And so they kind of traveled to where the real hot spots were. And I don't know if it's possible on the data that you have, but it would be good for us to also know what percent of those nurses were the more traveling, transient type, and what nurses came from other states that not necessarily they are part of the traveling group of nurses. So it would be helpful to understand those dynamics just a little bit better. So as you and your staff get that information, if you could just add that, those additional layers to it, I think that would be incredibly helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Nelson. And Commissioner Malcolm, are we taking this all offline to follow up, because I think it's things that you have to research to get the data for. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. And we will need to go back to our contractor to get some of that additional data that, as Assistant Commissioner Reiterich mentioned, we don't know, for instance, where the nurses were recruited from. but we can see if we can get that from the vendor. Happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome aboard. And it's nice to actually have some of us in person here instead of Zooming all the interim time. So, Commissioner Malcolm, welcome back. And I just have kind of a general question, and I'm happy that Senator Coran asked questions about the money. And I'm really concerned actually about the pricing that we're paying, just destabilizing the whole nursing industry. I think it's $275 an hour. I don't know what the whole fee, if that's the whole fee, and then we pay them 180 or something, but that's what I'm interested to see. But just on the grander scheme, Mr. Chair, and to the whole topics, you know, money just keeps, here's 40 million, and then there's 5 million here, and then 40 and 40 we're talking about today. Just in the big picture, and you can let us know later today if you want, but at one point there was a lot of money, and then there was 200 million, and do you know how much money is left in the COVID relief that the governor has to still spend on stuff? And I'm just curious, like, if that includes ARP and the COVID flex dollars. And then I'm curious, I don't know if you track how much counties have left to help with some of these things. And are they, they're probably all voluntarily doing that, but it would be helpful to know, like, how much is left. And do you know offhand, Commissioner? Or,
Commissioner Malcolm?
And I'm willing to, I don't even need to know at this point, but just it'd be nice to know. So thank you.
If you were taking notes on that, you were speed writing because they were coming rapid fire. But
that's an easy question, Mr.
Chair. Yeah, go ahead, Commissioner Malcolm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Abel, nice to see you too. We'll have to get some of that from Minnesota Management and Budget in terms of the funds left. I don't know that we have any line of sight into county resources, but MMB may. So we'll get back to you on that.
And Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. And
yeah, Senator Abler.
You know, I'm glad I can ask complex questions, but I thought it was simple. But so what does the Department of Health take any interest in how the counties have spent their money? Is anybody tracking what they bought? I know our county got some. They did some business grants in the first round, none on the second. And is anybody just like seeing if there's, is any mission statements that you put with the money you would like them to do with stuff, or are they all on their own?
Commissioner Malcolm?
Mr. Chair and Senator Abler, again, I think that's probably a better MMB question. Certainly for the grant funds that we distribute out to local public health, for instance, we have, you know, data on that, certainly what are the functions that the local public health agencies are doing with the grant funds that pass through us. But in terms of that general ARP relief to the counties, I'm not aware that MNB does or doesn't have any line of sight to that, but we'll certainly follow up and ask.
Yeah, thank you. That's all I have for now.
Commissioner, I have one question, and if you mentioned it early on, I apologize, but we talked about the contract. What is the length of the contract, or what is, I noticed, you know, you've got staff working 60 hours a week for 60 days, but does the contract must go over a period of time? That's the staff that's coming in and then leaving, and there'll be replacements?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We originally envisioned this to be a 60-day contract, but for the very reasons you mentioned, we are going to need to just extend the timeline, not the total amount of funds, but the time over which the contract is in place, because staff are coming and going. So, I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Ryder has anything more to add there.
Ms. Redrick, anything additional?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The contract currently runs through March 31st, but as Commissioner Malcolm noted, we'll be extending it probably until the end of April or a little bit longer. No additional funding, but just allowing a little bit more time for people to be brought in and then replaced if needed.
Okay, thank you. We have no further questions here at the table, so Commissioner, you can jump into section number two.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this next strategy, also related to supporting our hospitals, is we refer to as the hospital decompression strategy. This was 2.49 from the governor's flexible funds and 5 million authorized by the LCRC for a total of just under 7.5 million. And this is where we work with selected skilled nursing facilities to beef up their staffing so that they are able to take more discharges from acute care facilities for patients who still need rehabilitation, some post-acute care, but no longer require hospital-level care. And the staffing for that is a combination of private vendors, also these temporary staffing agencies that everybody's been using, the health systems, the nursing facilities, and the state with our contracts as well. So private vendors provide nurses and certified nursing assistants for these decompression sites. The Minnesota National Guard is also providing some certified nursing assistant and temporary nursing assistant support for those facilities. And the focus of these decompression sites is really to take, at least so far in the early weeks of this effort, because of their own staffing constraints, taking lower severity patients, lower acuity patients. So it's folks who don't need a great deal of care. Among these different, the private vendors and the National Guard, we've been able to provide 80 or a little more than 80 FTEs to these decompression sites. The National Guard folks are no longer in the initial four decompression sites. They've been able to rotate out and be replaced by these other vendor staffing. We did just on the 31st of January, the National Guard is supporting, without any other vendor resources, a four-week mission in an additional site that was set up specifically to take COVID-positive recovering patients. The other decompression sites were not set up to take COVID-positive patients in that program. So we now have a site that that can take COVID-positive or COVID-recovering patients. So through this decompression strategy, we've had been able to make a total of 116 beds available to facilitate hospital discharges, and 303 admissions so far to date through that program. For the rest of the program, and we do anticipate extending these decompression sites through much of the spring, we anticipate this need. And we will be working with the decompression sites, and they are ramping up to be able to take somewhat higher acuity patients for the remainder of the time. And that has been a need expressed by the hospitals as well. We're also working with some of the health systems who have very innovative home care-based support for earlier discharges from the hospital, where folks can get at-home care to patients who still have needs, for sure. They're either recovering from COVID or they've got some other complex condition that needs home care, but they no longer need hospital level care. So working with them to see how we can support that strategy with resources as well. I think there's only one slide on the decompression strategy. Could you just advance one? Oh, I'll just mention this and then we can take any questions on this piece. These are just some of the things we look at to see what a difference these strategies are making. On the left there, you see a line graph of the number of patients who are waiting in the emergency department for 4 hours or more before they can be admitted to a bed, either ICU or medical surgical. And you can see since the beginning of January, we've had on average 146 people every day waiting for 4 hours or more in the ED. And you can see that that dropping. You can see it growing as the Omicron wave hit and dropping as more staffing was made available. We haven't seen a tremendous, we are starting to see a decline in hospitalized folks with COVID, but that is very recent. The hospitalizations typically lag case growth or case decline by a couple of weeks. So this is one indicator that the staffing support and the decompression is making an impact. And the one on the right just looks at the number of people who are waiting to be placed in a higher level of care through the critical care coordinating center, the C4. And there you can see also the, you know, the growth through the Delta wave and then the Omicron wave, and now the decline in hospitals needing to transfer their patients elsewhere, which is a sign that the hospitals are getting more stabilized in terms of the staffing they have available. So a couple of metrics there. So we can just see if there are any questions on the decompression strategy with the skilled nursing facilities.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Yes, Senator Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Malcolm, could you help in plain English for everybody that's watching? So decompression site, please tell us what those are. You've described what they're doing and what we're trying to do in expanding their capacities, but are we talking about our traditional nursing homes, or have you created a new category with new facilities?
Commissioner Malcolm?
Mr. Chair, Senator Curran, thank you. That is a good thing to clarify. So decompression literally means that hospitals have many patients in them. They have had right now, as the nursing facilities are under a lot of staffing pressure also. The nursing facilities, because they're really understaffed, have not been able to take the normal volume of discharges from the hospitals that they normally would with full staffing. So the patients have gotten backed up in the hospitals. They don't need to be there medically, but there's not a bed, a staffed bed, to provide the level of care and rehabilitation that they do need. So we worked with, these are existing skilled nursing facility sites who were willing to be part of this program, who had the right capabilities in terms of the facility and the mix of staffing that could be augmented by the vendors and by the National Guard. So these are all existing high quality, good track record nursing facilities who were willing to kind of ramp up to take more of the discharges from the hospitals.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Curran.
And Commissioner Malcolm, so I assume that was a long answer for nursing homes, correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Curran, yes, skilled nursing facilities.
Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up.
Okay, Senator Curran.
So, Commissioner Malcolm, you know, we've talked, these facilities, nursing homes, it'd be nice if we include that on the information so the average citizen knows what those are, or what we're speaking of. But we know those facilities were crushed or being crushed by policy and staffing long before the pandemic. And, you know, I've made the offer to you, and I'm going to make it in the form of a bill, that we have many, many Department of Human Services employees, many, many Department of Health employees, that it appears that you're not removing them from their traditional jobs or reallocating them to be trained and certified as a CNA, a DSP, or a PCA to help alleviate this. Our National Guard is not the solution to our government's continued lack of performance in meeting these needs long before the pandemic. This exacerbated it, don't get me wrong. And we need these short-term, we need to do something short-term. But what I'd ask is in our future meetings, I'd like to know when you're going to start deploying. There's some 8,500 DHS employees. Some provide direct care service, most don't. If we deem it necessary to pull the National Guard out of their vital employment and further exacerbate the economy, I think we should be doing the very same, because I don't understand how your agency or the Department of Human Services can understand what the real needs are from policy and finance unless you've actually done the job yourself. And I can't think of a better way to be prepared for the next pandemic or health emergency than to accomplish that task. And I'll be asking you to walk shoulder to shoulder with me, as I have since I have arrived. Now, if you don't take action, this is on you and the rest of the staff to be prepared for the next emergency, whatever that may be. So thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner, any comment that you want to make on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Curran, one thing I can tell you is that a lot of the staff in MDH who do have background working in these skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes, assisted living, or other care settings, and they work in infection control now, supporting with their supporting crisis staffing for these facilities. So I would just only say that we do have that that awareness of life in the nursing homes, and are doing, I think, a lot to try to support them. That it is helpful work, helping with infection control, helping them to access the crisis staffing support that DHS has been able to provide. So I do believe we're trying to meet the spirit of your question.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund, get you next up.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit, Commissioner Malcolm, about kind of the geographical distribution of some of these, the decompression sites and the personnel. Have regional areas kind of worked together on what they need and received assistance in, you know, helping out in a region like that? Or I guess just more, if you could talk a little bit about how it's been distributed across the state as far as the need and the responses of people being willing to stand up a site in their area.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wicklund, so we're talking here about the specific strategy with a select number of nursing homes to just help with these hospital discharges, being able to take more. And this was a sort of an application process of facilities that were interested and willing to do this. And I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Rydrick to comment on their distribution. But just wanted to quickly mention, in addition to this, we have a lot of support going to skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes all over the state through crisis staffing and through National Guard teams that are there to support the nursing home staff, not about taking more hospital discharges, but just helping them, shoring them up. Assistant Commissioner Rydrick, do you have anything you could add on anything more on the decompression sites?
Ms. Rydrick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Wicklund, yes. So that we definitely took a regional approach for the decompression sites to the greatest extent possible. So the sites are in Shakopee, Brainerd, Hastings, and then St. Paul, and then actually two in St. Paul now with that small site that just opened last week. And we've worked closely with the regional coalitions to make sure that there's an organized process for health systems in those regions to be able to refer people to those beds. And so, you know, a health system that has kind of their catchment area and their patients coming from one region can refer to the site in that region, so it's a little bit better flow and just a fairer process across sites. And I really appreciate Commissioner Malcolm calling out the broader range of supports that we provide to nursing homes and long-term care. I do think it's important to note that, you know, since almost the beginning of the pandemic, we've had what we call the long-term care battle plan team, and they provide crisis staffing support to nursing homes. Currently, at this moment, almost 50 nursing homes and long-term care facilities are getting crisis staffing management support and access to a staffing database to help them meet their needs when they have a COVID outbreak. And we have used the National Guard for response teams for facilities, excuse me, that are struggling with their staffing crises as well. And I believe the tally there is just north of 40 nursing homes that have received support there as well, just to help them get through a really difficult period. And those supports have been provided for long-term care facilities all around the state.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund, any follow-up? I just want to make sure you get a chance to get your question answered.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Klein.
Well, thank you, Chair Utke and Commissioner Malcolm. And Commissioner, I do not have a question, but I just want to thank you as a practitioner who's been practicing on the COVID wards now for the last several months. Entirely appropriate is your choice of the words hospital decompression, because I can tell you that if you're a healthcare provider, you're either a doctor or a nurse, or if you're a patient or a patient's family member waiting in the emergency department for a bed that is not available, decompression is precisely what you have accomplished by opening up these discharge beds. I thought it was particularly innovative that you have the COVID-only discharge plan, not a traditional nursing home, that was staffed by the National Guard. As you recall, over the last 18 months of this pandemic, discharging COVID-positive patients has been particularly challenging and fraught with ethical concerns, whether you're discharging them to a multi-generational house or to an existing nursing home facility and potentially exposing other patients. Those were very difficult discharges and often resulted in several day delays in an effort not to spread the virus further. So I thought that was innovative and correct. It will absolutely accomplish decompression. It will save lives not only for the patient's discharge, but for those waiting long periods in the emergency department with heart disease or cancer or blood clots or infections, et cetera. So solid work by the department, and thank you again from a practitioner.
Thank you, Senator Klein. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple more questions. One actually related to the comments from Senator Klein, and then two questions that aren't really necessarily onto these two slides. But the one question had to do with that decompression. And you might remember, Commissioner, I was concerned about taking understanding the need for decompression to open up those hospital rooms, but that concern, that ethical concern about if the virus was then being transferred into our long-term care facilities where some of our, where our most vulnerable are. And I think your answer was that that did not happen, and you particularly had areas that were COVID only, so that COVID positive patients were not released into long-term care facilities, is what I understand. If maybe you could just shed a little bit of light on that, if that's what happened. Did we see any known cases where COVID positive patients were put into long-term care facilities that actually, you know, then would have posed some sort of risk? I'm just wondering if you could add just a little bit more light on that, because I know that has been a concern. Certainly was a concern of mine and for many of my constituents too.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, thank you. Yes, as you might recall, we have had this conversation a number of times, and some nursing facilities have developed whole separate wings to be able to deal with COVID positive residents who are staying there in the facility, or potentially who could be transferred in, but with very, very specific criteria about what sort of a setup is required to be able to do that. I did say that these initial four skilled nursing facilities that are serving as decompression sites, they have not been taking COVID positive patients. They've been taking fairly low acuity patients. They are now working to be able to take somewhat higher acuity patients, not necessarily COVID positive. The facility that Senator Klein mentioned is a transitional care unit co-located with Regions Hospital. They are licensed as skilled nursing facility beds, but this is a kind of a hospital-based transitional care unit, which is specifically taking COVID positive discharges. I hope that clarifies.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow-up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, yes, it does. And I would just mention, too, I don't know that you have an answer today, and hopefully we are beyond this now, that we are on the other side of this pandemic and hopefully moving towards an endemic stage. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention some of the concerns from some of my constituents, specifically in our long-term care facilities or our independent living that are paired with those skilled nursing areas. And the questions that they had were this, which I think there's some answers that would be helpful. One, you know, so yes, there's these designated COVID wings, but do they have a separate HVAC system? Or what about the staff that goes from wing to wing? In other words, while there may be different COVID wings, the staff is not necessarily assigned to that particular wing, and then they bring maybe the dinner or whatever to the other parts of the long-term care facility. So those are a couple concerns that if you have an answer to it to address that, please do. If not, you know, I just want to make sure you're well aware of those additional concerns.
Thank you, Senator, or Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, we certainly can follow up with some additional information on what are the kind of the requirements and the protocols for those skilled nursing facilities. And you did ask earlier what data we have on whether there has been any transmission within the facility from such transfers. And I haven't seen that recently. I know earlier on we had data that showed there was actually zero incidence of transmission in those situations, but I will want to check back with the staff and get you some updated information there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair, I have two further
Senator
questions.
Nelson's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two further questions, but they're not necessarily related to this piece of the presentation, so I'll hold on to those, but I would like another opportunity to ask the commissioner a couple other questions.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner, I have a question just looking at the graphs that are still on the screen from the slides. What would those lines or what would those graphs have looked like pre-COVID before we got into this? Has there always been some delay or wait, but they'd be very minimal, or just for curiosity?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. We can ask some of our hospital colleagues about that. I think 4 hours to wait in an ED for a bed is a long time, and that's considered kind of significant because there's some data suggesting poor outcomes associated with longer wait times before people can get into the bed. But what is the normal average? It's an interesting question. I will see if we can track that down for you.
Okay, thank you. And with that, I don't see any other hands on the screen. So, Commissioner, if you wanted to move into section number 3.
Great, thank you very much. Moving now into what's going on with testing. There was a $40 million appropriation out of the federal ARP funds to continue making COVID-19 testing more available to Minnesotans, specifically around expanding rapid tests, as those have become very much in demand and very useful to people to be able to kind of manage and know their own status in a very convenient way with these at-home tests. So these funds were specifically to augment the rapid tests available to Minnesotans. Assistant Commissioner Joanna Dornfeld is on the meeting and can speak to more of the details here if you have questions. But Joanna and her team have been working with the manufacturers of these various kinds of rapid tests with whom we have good relationships and have been buying tests to increase the supply that's available to us. This is another situation where states are kind of competing against each other to get access to a resource that is, there's more demand than supply at the moment nationally. But combined with what the Department of Health and Human Services federally has rolled out with some of their expanded testing resources, we think that this increased investment of ARP funds by Minnesota will increase testing access, particularly for some high priority populations, for communities disproportionately affected by COVID-19. The next slide looks at kind of what the current state of testing is. And these are our community test sites that offer a mix of the PCR test, kind of the gold standard test, as well as the rapid tests. We did open a new site that was federally supported, a FEMA site in St. Paul in the Department of Transportation's cafeteria area that has the capacity for 1,000 tests a day. That is a time-limited mission running until February 14th. That augmented the 21 existing community test sites that we have across the state. We expanded that capacity in fall as we were climbing up the Delta wave and expanded it further with the Omicron surges. We added some additional sites. We expanded capacity at some of those sites, lengthening hours, adding staffing to be able to administer more tests. And we monitor very closely what is the testing demand at each one of these sites so that we can meet that demand and move capacity around as needed. In addition to these community sites, we distributed 150,000 at-home rapid tests to vulnerable communities through community partners like local public health, food shelves, and others. And in addition to that, we have 1.8 million at-home rapid tests specifically for school districts to use now and throughout the spring semester. And 450,000 at-home rapid tests have been secured for childcare also in the spring semester. Next slide. Actually, that's the end. Just back up one, and we can just pause for your questions there on testing.
Commissioner, I've got a question I'll start out with. Looking at with these rapid tests, you know, I remember when this was last month, when from the federal government, they promoted the rapid tests going out and that they were free, but yet anybody that had commercial pay insurance, you filed an insurance claim. So they really weren't free. The insurance companies were covering it to whatever degree they did. Of the numbers that you're showing us here, are these all going out in applications where insurance does not apply? They're going to people who don't have coverage, or we're just in general going to public health type facilities?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I invite Assistant Commissioner Dornfeld to comment here too. The federal program, you know, they are directly shipping free tests to people's homes when people go on the federal website and request them. I think the max is four tests per household. But in addition to that, so those are the free ones from the federal government. Our tests that I'm describing here are all free and distributed through community partners, as mentioned. And in addition to that, there is, as you said, the policy that insurance is to cover the out-of-pocket costs for out-of-home or for rapid tests that are purchased in pharmacies, for example, that can then be reimbursed for. But these tests that we're talking about here are there's no insurance reimbursement involved here. These are distributed directly to communities through the partners.
Okay. Thank you. And you'd mentioned Assistant Commissioner Dornfeld. Did she have something additional, or
that was? Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Joanna Dornfeld, I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And Commissioner Malcolm communicated exactly what we are, how we're operationalizing this program currently.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the discussion. And, you know, it's good to see all the efforts to make our way through this really challenging time. So Anoka has one of these sites right at the Armory again. It was closed and open. I just didn't know it wasn't still open, but it's there. And so that's kind of lucky for people in my town. I was talking to some of my Iron Range friends, and they don't have the same opportunities, it sounds like. Canada apparently is requiring a PCR test, not a rapid one. And so have you thought about what happens to people who live up in Grand Portage or have a truck driver they're trying to get across and, you know, like the northern fringes, particularly where it's another country? And is there a plan to put one someplace up there? And if you did, what would it cost? Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Abler, again, I'll call on Assistant Commissioner Dornfeld here. I know that we have been doing a lot of talking and consulting with employers about kind of some of those border issues, and of course there's a sort of a cost-benefit kind of analysis that needs to go with how much demand does there need to be to support a community testing site, as opposed to trying to make sure that we're supporting, whether it's local public health or healthcare or pharmacies, to be able to meet that demand in some of those areas. But Joanna, could you chime in here?
Ms. Dornfield?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The department is in active communication, not only with local public health, but emergency managers and others throughout the state, but particularly along the northern border, to understand how we can support the varying testing needs throughout the state. Through the course of the fall, the Department of Health went through our competitive RFP process to bring 12 testing vendors onto master contracts with the state. And those master contracts are available also to local units of government. And so they are a resource that local units of government can utilize to identify and address specific community testing needs. But again, we are in conversation with our partners along the northern border with some of the testing requirements to cross the border, to just understand how we can best address those needs that are, we anticipate will be ongoing.
Thank you, Senator Abler.
Thanks, and follow-up. Well, I appreciate that answer. But I've wondered, actually, all along here with vaccination sites and testing sites, we have a lot of, people out there doing things that can actually do a pretty good job of this. Just already without having another site. And I don't know what it costs to set up a site, and I don't know why you need Anoka, it's kind of nice to have the armory used because it's kind of quiet there sometimes, but just two blocks away is a CVS, and just three blocks the other way is a big Health Partners operation. And so I guess I'm kind of nervous just from the grand scheme of it, how the easy money has caused us to be not as, frugal with the money that we have and focus on what really needs to be done. And so I don't know if Anoka really needs a site, just to be honest. Don't tell people, but I mean, tell them. Yeah, they'd be happy. We're trying to make their money go as far as they can. This money came from somewhere. It's actually worth $30 trillion in federal debt, which is, I think, real money pretty quickly coming here. $30 trillion. They're $2 trillion ahead of what they thought would have hit 2026, but it's a growth industry. And so this money is not going to be available, and so I just hope as you scrutinize what you're doing that you look where it really needs to be. And I look at the list of sites, and they're almost all metro, with all respect to North Branch. I don't know how you're going to make it in greater Minnesota. I represent the metro, so northern suburbs, but we do all really care about what goes on statewide. And so hopefully you can get that done soon. The northern border has just crushed. Their economy has just been ruined between Canada and their issues and back and forth with closing borders. So anyway, I hope you can get that squared away. And thank you for working on it. And take my advice for what it's worth. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Any comments, Ms. Dornfield or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members.
Oh. Go ahead, please.
The only thing that I was going to add is that I would say I think the most recent expansions are what highlighted on the slide, as we were working to kind of meet demand as we kind of saw the Omicron surge increase. But we do have 13 of our 21 sites that are in greater Minnesota, and I certainly hear your point, Senator Abler, about our healthcare partners and others who also offer testing services. And we've been hearing a need from them as they've been dealing with the surge in cases as well to help augment their ability to test. But it's certainly an ongoing conversation that we have, if not weekly, on a daily basis with all of our testing partners to right size our response to both meet the needs of Minnesotans, but also rely on our healthcare systems as they are able to kind of continue to take on this work. But appreciate the feedback.
Thank you. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question has to do with the end date of some of these testing sites. I know it's unusual to bring that up, but I see on our slide here it says new federal test site through February 14th in St. Paul. Overall, what do you see? How long are we going to continue with these test sites? Are there metrics in place? where we're going to close sites after we don't test as much? What, I guess, what's kind of the off-ramp of these testing sites and some of these resources? Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dreheim, great question, and this is something that Joanna and her team are literally working on day-to-day, is to track those metrics. And we are seeing testing demand fall, particularly in the metro area, testing demand still on the increase in, or was as of last week, in some of our greater Minnesota sites, as Senator Rabo mentioned. So we do kind of move resources around and redeploy staff from a less used site to a more used site. So that is a continuing and ongoing process. And you know, there's not like a specific date. It's very much driven by what's going on with case counts. We're certainly happy to see those falling, but again, not falling equally in all parts of the state. So not a precise answer to your question, I'm afraid, but we do monitor the demand very closely. But would turn back to Assistant Commissioner Dornfeld for perhaps any more detail you can offer.
Ms. Dornfeld?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think Commissioner Malcolm kind of captured it well. You might remember last summer, the state did decommission a number of testing sites. And so our testing footprint was much smaller over the summer months because we were not seeing the demand across the state. But then we began to add additional sites in the fall as we saw our Delta numbers increase. And then certainly we added even more sites to get to kind of this maximum capacity that we're currently operating under in December as we kind of saw the Omicron surge. So I would expect as we continue to, assuming we continue to see testing volume decline, that we'll be right-sizing our testing footprint to best meet the needs of Minnesotans, but not, but be very conscious of the resources we're using. And I continue to monitor case counts and other metrics closely to determine if there would be a need for the state to step in at a point in the future.
Thank you. Any follow-ups, Senator Graham? Okay. Looks like we've reached the end of questions on that section. So, Commissioner, we can go on to the number two there, where we've got Minnesota Department of Health monoclonal antibody treatment and distribution report.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, if additional questions come to members on any of what we've covered, please let us know and we will get back to you with the questions that you asked during the session here. So moving on to monoclonals, the next slide just gives a very quick visual picture of how do monoclonal antibodies work. As you probably have seen many a time by now, that the thing that looks like a Nerf ball with stuff in it is that is the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and all those little blue things are spike proteins. And that is, the spike protein is what these monoclonal antibodies are designed to attach to, so that it literally can block the virus from being able to attach to human cells if it's got that monoclonal antibody kind of stopping up that connection. So that's how, what they're designed to do and how they work is by blocking that attaching to that receptor site and blocking the spike protein from being able to get into the cell. Next slide. This talks about the various kinds of treatments there are, and we're talking today about monoclonals, that first box, but there are, as I'm sure you know, oral antivirals that are a couple of them on the market and are anticipated to be really big deal in improving access to treatment. There's also an IV antiviral called remdesivir. You can see on the table there who those are for and the fact that the orals and the IV are likely effective against Omicron. Interesting, just a quick comment on remdesivir. Remdesivir was used successfully earlier on in the pandemic against the Alpha variant, but it was ineffective against Delta. But then it's effective against Omicron. So it's just a, you know, an indicator that each variant affects the spike proteins differently. And that's what affects whether the monoclonals or the treatments work or not work against a specific variant. So it's as we learn more and more, the specificity of what mutations are associated with which variant is what's going to determine how successfully existing treatments are or are not. So back to the top box with the monoclonal antibodies, those top two there, kind of abbreviated as BAM-EDI, the first one, and CASI-MDEBI, the second one, those showed good effect against hospitalization and death pre-Omicron, but are all but ineffective against Omicron. And the first one was available for all ages, you know, including infants. The second one for adults and only kids of 12 or older. Now, the third antiviral, so sotrovimab, is the one that is still useful against Omicron. It was useful against the earlier strains, and it does retain some effectiveness against Omicron. But the first two, essentially none, which is why not too long ago the authorization for use of those first two was revoked from the emergency use authorization, and no more of those products are being distributed to Minnesota or anywhere for Omicron. It doesn't mean they might not be effective against additional variants in the future. But at the present time, among the monoclonals, only sotrovimab is useful against Omicron. But again, just pointing out that the orals, molnupiravir is the Merck product, and that one is quite a bit less effective than Paxlovid, the Pfizer oral antiviral, but still some effect. And both of those retain some effectiveness against Omicron. And again, remdesivir, interesting story that that it has come back into use with Omicron. So the next one talks about the supply situation. What's on the left there is just, you can see what the different waves of the major variants have been between Alpha, Delta, and then Omicron, and just how very quickly, Delta grew pretty quickly and was the dominant strain for months in Minnesota. And it took practically no time, as was true in other states or countries and states and cities as well. Omicron just outcompeted Delta very, very quickly. It's so much more transmissible. So you can see here, going back to the middle of November, what our weekly allocation from the federal government to Minnesota has been. These products are allocated to each state by the federal government. And sometimes it's based on a per capita allocation, just on a population basis. Sometimes it's based on case rates and hospitalization rates. And they've kind of gone back and forth on that allocation methodology. But you can see here for each of those weeks what our allocation from the feds was for the three monoclonals. And you can see that the first two that were very useful against Delta, that's what we had the most of. We've never had a lot of sotrovimab. So when we lost those first two in terms of their effectiveness against Omicron, the ineffectiveness against Omicron, it was a major step backwards in terms of the effective treatments against Omicron specifically. So just looking at the, and as you see down as of the week of the 24th of January, there is no more of those first two monoclonals authorized for use against Omicron, and none coming to us. So sotrovimab, there you can see, there we were getting an allocation only every couple of weeks for a while. The high watermark for sotrovimab was the week of December 17th, where we got almost 1,400 courses of treatment. And then you can see that dropped rather precipitously over the next few weeks as national demand really exploded with the Omicron wave. But now, gratefully, in the last couple of weeks, we've started to see the supply inch back up again. So that is a welcome development, to be sure. So the next slide talks about how do we allocate these monoclonal antibodies. And we've got what's laid out in our guidance to providers is essentially three stages of how supply and demand are correlated for these monoclonals. In stage one, which is where we want to be, where there's sufficient supply for everyone who is clinically eligible for a monoclonal, and that is specifically spelled out in the emergency use authorization, like which medical conditions put someone at higher risk of disease progression, of severe disease. So that stage one is when everybody who fits those categories as spelled out in the emergency use authorization, there's enough supply to meet all of that demand. But the patients do have to fulfill all of the other EUA criteria, not only their clinical condition, but these monoclonals have to be given within 10 days of onset of symptoms. And this is for mild to moderate illness. People who are already hospitalized for COVID are not eligible for monoclonals. In stage two, which is where we are currently, this is a clinical prioritization stage where there's not enough supply of sotrovimab in the state for everyone who is clinically eligible under the EUA. So there's more people who are eligible for sotrovimab than there are courses of treatment available. So in that situation, we use a scoring system developed by the Mayo Clinic and validated by researchers at the University of Minnesota that creates a score based on the risk profile of patients. And in stage two, we're prioritizing those who score higher on this modified MASS score. The score is driven by the underlying conditions, risk characteristics, and pregnancy is a kind of an independent variable because there's such high risk associated with pregnancy and more severe COVID outcomes that pregnancy is sort of a qualifying condition in and of itself. So this is kind of a dynamic process where the cutoff is, like below which people are deprioritized, depends upon how deep is the scarcity. Can everybody who's got a score of at least one, is there enough supply for everybody with scores of at least one? Is there enough supply for scores of two and above, then three and above, then four and above? Which is with the higher numbers being higher risk scores. This is not about saying people with scores lower than that or who score zero on the MMAS. It doesn't mean they're not eligible. It does mean that the higher risk people are served first. So hopefully that's clear. And I believe Dr. Sarah Lim is on the call and can help explain this in more detail if you have questions here. In stage three, which is where it gets even more difficult, I mean, prioritization of any kind, when there's an important resource and there's not enough of it, it's just a very, very difficult decision situation for everyone to be in. You can't meet all the legitimate demand that is there. In stage three, this is a weighted randomization process where you don't have enough capacity of either the drug, the monoclonal itself, or appointments. Because again, the healthcare providers are so stretched thin with staffing challenges that they aren't able to just create more and more and more appointment capacity for monoclonals. And this is part of where the state has stepped in to try to augment infusion capacity for monoclonals as well. But in stage three here with weighted randomization, don't have enough supply for even people with scores of four or above, or who are pregnant. And four, it was chosen as the cutoff, because that's sort of a pretty significant break point where everyone with an MS score of four or above or pregnant has more than a 10% risk of progressing to hospitalization. So those lower MAS scores have a much lower risk of hospitalization to begin with. So in this weighted randomization selection, people with higher scores get have a higher chance of being randomized. And we have a system called the Minnesota Resource Allocation Platform, or MNRAP, that is used to do sort of an instant read process of where, you know, where the supply, where the patient falls in terms of their ranking for the available supply, and where's the nearest appointment slot. I will say that this MNRAP platform is not required to be used. Most of our health systems are using this MNRAP system. It's a great way of getting a quick match for patients with available appointments, but there are some systems that have opted out of that, and they sort of using their own process, but they've agreed to use processes that create the same fairness, if you will, from a clinical and ethical perspective of being able to give access to folks in their region, for example, who are not existing patients of that health system. So there's a lot of detail there that we can go into if you're interested, but that's that is sort of how the allocation system changes depending upon what that supply and demand match or mismatch is. I think that might be the last slide here. Yes, it is. So maybe we can back up to that last slide. So I'm guessing folks might have some questions on that, and we'll open it up right there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Question for you, as you were talking about the treatments, and they were the first three that were listed back a couple slides ago, and the top two had were not effective now for Omicron. But are those oral treatments, or what type of a treatment are they?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those top three are all infusion. So they require a patient to come to an infusion site and to be to get, you're not hospitalized, but you have to go and have an infusion of these monoclonal antibodies. So all three of those are not orals, they are infusions. And then the two below that are the pill form, which is obviously when there's more supply of those and effectiveness of those, that will be great, because that will make access to treatment so much more widely available.
Thank you. Senator Abler.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just, this is fascinating. I just, I know there's other terms, but this is certainly, you know, cool biochemistry and all the interactions, and there's probably even more terms for that. But so I'm just got a couple of questions, and I could actually ask questions for the rest of the day, but that would not be polite. So these monoclonal antibodies, these are not natural, right? These are produced by these different companies. So they're not natural. They're not natural antibodies you've harvested. They're made somewhere, right?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Abler, that you're correct. There are naturally produced antibodies by the human body, but most of those are polyclonal, not monoclonal. These monoclonals are highly targeted to the specific thing that they're trying to intercept. Dr. Lim, are you on the call still?
Welcome, Dr. Lim. Or Lim,
yes.
Oh, welcome.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Lim. I'm an infectious disease physician at MDH. Yes, you're correct. These are synthetic antibodies. I believe actually sotrovimab was initially derived from a patient that had survived COVID-19 and was a unique antibody that they had produced. But what is commercially available is these are synthetic forms of human antibodies, and they are very specific. They each target very specific epitopes or portions of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, which means that they are very effective at reducing the risk for severe illness. As you can see, those are data from the clinical trials, but it means that when mutations occur in the spike protein, as we saw with Omicron, that it, depending on where that monoclonal antibody is targeting to attach, that that it can lose effectiveness if that particular piece of the spike protein has been mutated. So sotrovimab is targeting a fairly conserved part of the spike protein, so it has retained its efficacy against Omicron as well as other variants, but the other two, unfortunately, are no longer effective.
Yeah, no, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Abler.
I just think I'm gonna have to behave because I have so many questions. Maybe somebody could let me know offline, like, what's in these things? And I have no objection to, you know, synthetic ones if they work just as well. But I do have a real question these are all real questions, but if there's just some way to, like, send me a chart that I could understand about really what's inside of those. I don't imagine it's nuclear material, it's something. Commissioner, are we in stage three now, would you say, or are we to stage two?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Senator Abler, we are in stage two now, clinical prioritization, up until, I think it was either Friday or over the weekend, we were actually in stage three for a time with the kind of that weighted allocation process. The clinical prioritization worked really well for us during the latter part of Delta and the early parts of Omicron. But again, as the national demand just spiked and our supply went down, we found ourselves for a period of time in stage three. But Dr. Lim can correct
Mr. Chair, that's fine for now. Just a bit. And so when you were in stage three, is this when we did the racial decision about who gets stuff and who don't get stuff? And is that right,
Commissioner?
That may be a sensitive question, but this was when we did that, and right? Or is that correct? Am I wrong?
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Abler, actually, when we were talking about race and ethnicity as a risk factor, that's language straight out of the FDA's emergency use authorization, and we're talking about that as sort of at the population level. When we went to clinical prioritization, the race and ethnicity was not a part of the scoring system in stage two or three.
Well, thank you, and Mr. Chair.
Senator Abler?
Just about done with this. I have maybe a question at the end, but I'm glad we're worrying about people that have the greatest need. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Thank you for the overview. Just a couple questions. Understanding that the remaining monoclonal is effective, but given within only 10 days of symptoms. And I'm wondering about those people who are suffering with COVID in our ICUs now. They've been there for longer than 10 days. It sounds like monoclonal antibodies, even the one that works on Omicron, is not effective. I know I didn't hear you say much about the antivirals. What works for those patients who have been hospitalized for more than 10 days? Is it the antivirals? Is it the remdesivir? What are their therapies if they've been having COVID symptoms for longer than 10 days?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, thanks for that. And I'm going to call on Dr. Lim here to address that, whether it's a question of effectiveness or eligibility for already hospitalized patients.
Dr. Lim?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson. So for patients who are already hospitalized, the monoclonal antibodies are not currently indicated. They have been studied in patients who are hospitalized and who are requiring oxygen for severe COVID-19, and they have found that they are not effective and in some cases may even be harmful. So in some cases, patients who are hospitalized who are found incidentally to have COVID-19, but they are not hospitalized for COVID-19, they may be treated with these monoclonals, but they are not for patients who are in the ICU. So for those patients who have been already hospitalized, who have severe illness, there are a number of other treatment options. The oral antivirals are, again, not indicated. These are really intended for patients who are earlier on in their treatment course with the goal of reducing the risk of hospitalization. But IV remdesivir is indicated for use in hospitalized patients. It's probably best given earlier before you get sick enough that you need to be admitted to the ICU. So that is one drawback, but it certainly can be used in patients who are in the ICU. And then there are a number of other treatment options. Steroids, for example, dexamethasone has been found to reduce mortality when given to hospitalized patients with severe COVID-19. And then there are one or two other options that work as immunosuppressants. So baricitinib or tocilizumab is another. And these are really targeting the inflammatory response with severe COVID-19 that is causing end organ damage. The one other treatment option for patients who are hospitalized is convalescent plasma. If given, again, early on, and if the high titer convalescent plasma is used, that can have some efficacy as well. But for the therapies that we're discussing here, the monoclonal antibodies, in general, they are not for the sickest patients.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Nelson, you have a follow-up?
Not to that question. I do have a question for either now or later, but just about what the commissioner and her staff might see in our near future, additional variants. I hear a lot about getting to that state where we're endemic, like perhaps the flu, that type of thing. You know, what, nobody has a crystal ball, but I think the Department of Health might have one of the nearest. When is that? And you can save that question till later if it's not appropriate at this point, but I would like to have a little discussion about that.
Commissioner, I don't know if it's something you want to tackle now. Otherwise, we've got one more question to go, and then we'll bring this in for a wrap-up.
Right. Mr. Chairman, if there's one other question on the monoclonals, let's go back to there, and then we can come back to Senator Nelson's future question.
Okay. Senator Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Malcolm, on the it was a great overview of all the various treatments. Question on the distribution. We were very clear, and you highlighted that for the monoclonal antibodies, but when you but you didn't cover all of the others. So the antivirals, are you using the same set of standards as we move through stage 1, 2, and 3 for all of the other treatments as well? And then I guess the last piece to that is, of the antivirals, are they all readily available so we don't have to worry about limitations or rationing those treatment methods?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Curran, unfortunately, no. I think the supply of the oral antivirals is also needs to ramp up over time. There are two of the oral antivirals, as you recall. Molnupiravir is the more plentiful, but it's far less effective than Paxlovid. Dr. Lim may have a better line of sight than I do to when we anticipate those supplies ramping up. But we do not use the MNRAP platform for oral antivirals or for remdesivir. That is kind of made by providers sort of in the immediate moment with their patients. Dr. Lim, have I misstated anything there?
Dr. Lim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corrin, no, Commissioner, I think you've highlighted the scarcity well. We are receiving allocations of the oral antivirals from HHS every 2 weeks. Molnupiravir in slightly greater quantities than Paxlovid, but I don't believe that we have enough supply yet to meet all available demand. We are recommending that providers use the modified mass scoring system when assessing patients for prioritizing the oral antivirals, particularly Paxlovid for those at higher risk, given that it appears to have better efficacy than molnupiravir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Abler, you have.
Mr. Chair, I know we're running low on time, but I just had a question just on the general stuff that we're doing, and I can take it offline at the commissioner or somebody would just chat with me about it. But I just curious how the conversation's going between MMB and the Department of Health with the latest updates. I know you're down to a 5-day thing. We talked with Mr. Haas last time about kind of a rubric. And so it seems like that communication isn't going along. It seems like you've gone to 5 days for them, but a lot of people don't know that. And then the questions about masking and spread and so on, it just remains an issue. And just so you know, you wouldn't know at the level of the commissioner, but people are still writing me. They feel just very challenged, and some have to wear goggles at MSOP now. And I'm just curious, just trying to help this to be fairly done for the employees that are so good for us. So I'll take that offline. And I don't need a response, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Abler. And thank you, Commissioner, for joining us today. Do you have any final comments you'd like to leave us with before we wrap up this meeting?
Well, I certainly appreciate your time and your good questions. We'll follow up offline. And just really quickly on Senator Nelson's last point there, I think we all have to keep our eye on just the still incredible degree of global spread of SARS-CoV-2. That's what's fueling all of these variants. Interestingly, SARS-CoV-2 is fairly stable as viruses go. The reason it's spinning off these many variants is because there are that many millions and millions of transmissions happening every day. So that's the wild card about, will there be more variants? What will they be like? And in terms of endemic, you could be in an endemic controlled state or an endemic crisis state. All endemic really means is that the rate of cases is fairly stable, but it can be stable at a dangerously high level that still is disruptive to the economy, to people's health and security and so forth. So we certainly are encouraged by what we're seeing now in terms of the waning case growth and looking forward to the day when that translates into fewer hospitalizations as well. But certainly we'll be in touch and be happy to brief the committee as the next few weeks we hope paint a clearer picture of where we are on the downslope.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner, and to all of your staff that joined us today. Members, our next meeting is Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, February 9th, and we'll be looking at COVID waiver languages. And so with that, if there's nothing further, we will stand adjourned for today and see you Wednesday.